The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Carroll, Part 2, continued. Andy got his money's worth. Many congressmen required House patronage employees, mailmen, elevator operators, gallery doorkeepers, to work an hour or two each day in their own offices after getting off work. But an hour or two was not what Johnson had in mind. He asked the House postmaster to assign Latimer to the earliest shift, which began at 5 a.m. and ended at noon. Johnson allowed Latimer to take a half hour for lunch, but no more. At 12:30 sharp each day, Latimer was to be in room 258, ready for work. This work might be over at 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, Latimer says, but often I would stay until 11:30 or midnight. During much of this time, Johnson would be out of the office, cultivating bureaucrats or other congressional secretaries. Latimer would be alone in 258, an 18-year-old boy working 18-hour days. Soon Johnson found a way to get even more work out of him. My job in the post office was sorting the mail, pitching it into different bins, and we made two or three deliveries each day. He urged me to pitch the mail faster, and I got so I did it faster than any other clerk, and then between deliveries I might have 90 minutes free at a time, and I'd run over to the office, Clayburgh's office, and do 90 minutes of typing before heading back to the post office for more mail sorting and delivering. And then, at the end of the shift, I'd rush over to that little corner place and eat that 15-cent stew and rush over to the office so I could be at work at 12:30. By the time Jones arrived in Washington, a third bed was moved into the little room at the Dodge. Clayburgh had been given a two-room suite, office 1322, in the new House Office Building, now known as the Longworth Building, which had just been opened alongside the old one. A routine was soon established for the staff of that office. It began before 5, when Johnson shook Latimer awake and started him on his way up Capitol Hill. Not long thereafter, he would awaken Jones. Pulling on their clothes, Johnson had taught Jones his trick of taking off his necktie, still knotted, so he wouldn't have to waste time tying it in the morning. Johnson and Jones would hurry out of the Dodge and up Capitol Hill in the dark, past the shadowy mass of the Capitol and into the Longworth Building. To avoid wasting time awakening the napping night elevator operator, they ran up the winding stairs, dimly lit from eagle sconces, to the third floor. Having raced through his mail sorting and delivering, Latimer would arrive at about the same time. At Johnson's request, he had been assigned to a route which included 1322, so he brought the mail himself. Ripping open the mail sacks, Johnson began sorting through the mail. "Reading it so fast that you couldn't believe he was reading it, but he was," Latimer says. At first, Johnson had dictated replies to every letter, but he had discovered that his former debater had a gift of Irish blarney with not only the spoken but the written word. Johnson wanted to flatter important people with whom he was corresponding, Latimer says, to butter them up, and he liked to have the butter laid on thick. It was almost impossible to put too much on. If he wanted to tell someone he liked him, he didn't want to say, "I like you." He wanted to say, "You're the greatest guy in the world," Latimer says. "I did get to be a master of laying it on, all right." And he is not exaggerating. A typical letter refers to Sam Four, a newspaper publisher from Floresville, as the St. Paul of Floresville. Soon Johnson, riffling through the mail as rapidly as if he were dealing a deck of cards, would hand many letters to Latimer with only the briefest of instructions. "Say yes, say no. Tell him we're looking into it. Butter him up." Latimer would expand those instructions exactly as Johnson wished. Johnson had, in fact, discovered a genius in a minor art form, the letter to constituents. When the last letter had been dealt, Latimer sat down at his desk in front of a heavy Underwood typewriter and began typing. To dictate replies to letters on which more detailed instruction was needed, Johnson would lead Jones, carrying a stenographer's pad, into the adjoining room, so that, as Latimer explains, his dictating wouldn't distract me, because my typewriter was supposed never to stop. When the dictating was finished and Jones had sat down at his Underwood, Johnson would mark up district newspapers, the big San Antonio and Corpus Christi dailies, and the scores of small-town weeklies, putting check marks next to the articles, a wedding, a birth, the opening of a new business, a local Kiwanis Club election, which merited a letter of congratulation. He insisted on getting every paper in the district, no matter how small, Latimer says. And some of those papers would just be filled with check marks. By the time most congressional offices opened and began sorting mail, Clayburgh's staff had finished sorting it and were well into answering it. By this time, government agencies were open, and Johnson would get on the phone to them, while the two typewriters clattered away. No coffee was allowed in Clayburgh's office because Johnson felt making it and drinking it would distract Latimer and Jones from their work. Less ominous distractions also were frowned on. If he caught you reading a letter from your mother, or if you were taking a crap, he'd say, "Son, can't you please try a little harder to learn to do that on your own time?" If Latimer asked if he could go out to buy cigarettes, Johnson would say, "What am I paying you for, buying cigarettes? Buy them on your own time." "Our job was to keep those typewriters humming," Latimer says. He would come down the hall, I could hear his heels clicking, and if he didn't hear both those typewriters going 90 miles per hour, he wanted to know what the hell was going on. The natural competitiveness of young men was used as a spur. "The chief has a knack, or better said, a genius, for getting the most out of those around him," Latimer recalls. "He'd say, 'Gene, it seems L.E. is a little faster than you today,' and I'd work faster. 'L.E., he's catching up with you.' And pretty soon we'd both be pounding for hours without stopping, just as fast as we could." The Depression was swelling the mail now, as more constituents asked for jobs and new government programs, and as veterans appealed more urgently for bonus prepayment. With only one or two staffers in each congressional office, many offices answered more and more of the mail with mimeographed form replies, or with pro forma promises, or simply didn't reply at all, and still fell further and further behind. Clayburgh's office answered personally every letter that could possibly be answered. For Lyndon Johnson, the mail possessed almost a mystique. At that time, government programs touched the lives of few constituents, so the mail, the only means by which a congressman could keep in touch with his district almost 2,000 miles from Washington, was a key to a congressman's power. Johnson could hardly have avoided hearing over and over about one former congressman or another who had lost touch with his district and who was a congressman no longer. But although other congressional staffers heard the same stories, they didn't answer every letter. For Lyndon Johnson, the mystique of the mail went beyond the political. He had always done every job as if his life depended on it, believing that if you did just absolutely everything you could do, you would succeed. He had tried to perform, perfectly, even minor tasks that no one else bothered with. For such a man, congressional mail, which consisted so largely of minor details, of small, unimportant requests, was a natural métier. Doing everything one could do with the mail meant answering every letter. That was what he insisted his office must do. And not only must every letter be answered, he told Latimer and Jones, it must be answered the very day it arrived. The only excuse that was accepted for not answering the same day was that you had lost a file, and boy, there'd better not be too many of those. Not being able to find a file, that was some sin, Latimer says. And if your reply said, "We have asked the Veterans Administration to look into this," you really had to ask that same day, so that the next day you could write another letter about it. The early morning mail delivery was only the first of three, and then four, and then five, made during the day, and still the bundles of each delivery grew heavier. Johnson would sort through the bundles, writing brief instructions on each letter about its handling, and dividing the letters between his two aides. After typing his way for hours through a pile of letters, Jones or Latimer would finally be almost to the bottom, and then Johnson would smack down on his desk another pile, a pile that, Jones says, might be a foot high. And before he would be allowed to leave the office that night, the pile would have to be gone. There was no escape from the mail. Small bundles meant not less but more work for the two young men. "It's important to get mail," Gene Latimer explains. "That was the most important thing. You had to have people writing you. So if the mail got light, we had to generate mail. Any day when we didn't get 100 letters was a terrible day, and we had to do something about it." Letters were solicited by scanning the weekly newspapers more closely than ever for any conceivable good or bad news that might justify a message of congratulation or condolence. A message in which the congressman would solicit a reply by asking, in Latimer's words, "How am I doing in Washington? What government programs would you like to see passed?" That kind of question. Then came the ultimate refinement of the congratulatory broadside. At some point, Latimer recalls, the mail fell off to a point at which we were receiving perhaps no more than double that of the usual member. This condition was intolerable for the chief, and he decided that each boy and girl graduating from high school in the 14th District that year should have a personal letter of congratulations from his congressman, commenting on his glorious achievement. There were literally thousands of such graduates each year. So began the production of lists, and concurrently the production of 40 or 50 letters, different, so the graduates would not receive the same letter. We had only to take the names in order and write each a personal letter from the congressman. We whacked away harder and harder and faster until we could recite those letters from left to right and from bottom to top. After the typing came the retyping. No letter was going out of the office unless it was perfect, Johnson said, and to ensure perfection he read every one. If he didn't like a letter, Latimer says, he would just make huge, angry slash marks across it. No explanation would be vouchsafed. You had to figure out what was wrong, Latimer says. He wouldn't tell you. A single error in spelling or punctuation, and the letter was slashed. He had no compunction at all about making you write them over, even if you had to stay past midnight, Jones says. You handed him 50, 60 letters, he might mark out every one of them. Sometimes Latimer and Jones would be finished with work by 8 or 9 o'clock, and would head back to Childs's for dinner, and then to the Dodge for the evening bull sessions. But usually they wouldn't be finished until 11:30 or midnight. Then they would return to their room to fall exhausted into their beds, to grab a few hours' sleep, for no matter how late they had worked the night before, they would be dragged from those beds at 5 o'clock the next morning. Recently completed on the long slope between the Dodge and the crown of Capitol Hill was an elaborate fountain, illuminated by colored lights that were turned on only between sunset and sunrise. "I almost never saw that fountain without the lights on," Latimer says. Returning from his work in the dark, he went back to his work while it was still dark. The willingness of the two teenagers to adhere to so brutal a routine, a 7-day routine, Clayburgh's office did not close on weekends, was based in part on admiration for their boss. Listening to him work the departments over the telephone, they heard him tailoring his approach to the individual he was talking to, bullying one bureaucrat with a threat of bringing down Congressman Clayburgh's displeasure on his head, or with increasing frequency masquerading as the congressman himself, pleading with another, "Look, I've got a problem. I've got to get you to help me," and obtaining results that they felt other secretaries could never have achieved. Listening, for example, to Johnson talking to the Veterans Administration about a veteran's request that a disability be considered connected to his war service, which would make the veteran eligible for a pension, Latimer and Jones would be awed by his glibness. "Damage suit lawyers have a jargon, you know," Jones says. "Johnson was adept at rationalizing like that. He could sit there and talk like a great lawyer or a doctor." And they were amazed by his persistence. "He took each case personally," Latimer says. "He wouldn't take no." While congressional offices routinely endorsed a veteran's request to the VA, denial of the request generally marked the end of the office's interest in the case. If the veteran was from the 14th District, however, the congressional secretary would react to the denial by taking up the case personally over the telephone. If the telephone appeal did not succeed, the secretary went to the VA in person. If the request was still denied, the secretary, without the veteran asking, filed a formal written appeal and procured him a lawyer. When the lawyer appeared before the Board of Veterans' Appeals, the secretary of the 14th District was also present. And if the case seemed to be going against his constituent, the secretary did not remain a silent observer. When Lyndon Johnson took a personal hand at a veterans' board hearing, he displayed his obsession with secrecy, asking that the stenographer be instructed not to take down his remarks, but he also displayed considerable persuasiveness. Reading the typed minutes of the hearing later, Latimer would invariably see the same sentence: "Mr. Johnson spoke off the record." I'd say to myself, "Here it comes." And sure enough, when they went back on the record again, the attitude would have changed. It was almost unheard of to get someone service-connected after it had been denied. But the chief did it, many times. The two teenagers' willingness to work so hard was based in part on their boss's ability to inspire enthusiasm. To Johnson, Jones says, every problem had a solution. He was completely confident, always optimistic. And this was contagious. It would absolutely grab a hold of you. Casework was, moreover, not only a crusade, but a crusade complete with triumphs, in which the whole office shared. Jones echoes Estelle Harbin. He would get ecstatic. I mean, we had won a real victory. They were also willing to work long hours because they were not working alone. If they awoke at 5, it was because their boss was awake at 5, and if they trudged up Capitol Hill before daylight, their boss trudged beside them. The days they spent chained to typewriters, he spent chained to the telephone, bullying and begging on behalf of their constituents. And often after they had returned to their little room and were falling asleep, they would hear their boss still tossing restlessly on his narrow bed. "He worked harder than anyone," Latimer says. "His head was still going around when the rest of us had knocked off." Other factors, however, were also involved. Sometimes Latimer rebelled. Rebellion was generally related to his fiancée. Although Johnson had brought him to Washington ostensibly so that he could be near her, the work schedule that Johnson had set up for him left little time for romance. He was allowed time off from the office to see her on Sundays after 3 p.m., and only on Sundays after 3 p.m. Johnson's response to rebellion might be a sneer with a particularly telling point. Once, when Latimer had requested an evening off and was being viciously tongue-lashed by Johnson for his temerity, "I couldn't stand it, and I packed the little wicker suitcase I'd come up with, and I said I was leaving." Towering over the little Irish boy, Johnson said, sneering, "How are you going to get back?" When Latimer, sobbing, said, as he recalls it, that he would rather hitchhike all the way to Texas than remain, Johnson said, "What are you going to do when you get there? How are you going to get a job? If you leave, how are you ever going to marry Marjorie?" Questions which enunciated an aspect of the Johnson-Latimer relationship that was generally unmentioned, but that was one of the realities that underlay it. That Latimer had no money, that his only source of money was Lyndon Johnson, that without Johnson he would not have a job, in a time when jobs were hard to come by. That, in short, he needed Johnson so badly that he had little choice but to do whatever Johnson wanted. The suitcase was unpacked, and Latimer remained. But rebellion was rare. To so skilled a reader of men, Gene Latimer was an easy text. Revolt could be anticipated, headed off. "He wouldn't really have a talk with you for months," Latimer says, "and then he would hug you, and he might spend an hour talking about your problems. He didn't do it very often, so you might think he was getting a hell of a lot for not very much, but if he did it very often, it wouldn't mean very much, you know." The way Johnson did it, it meant so much that the hug and the talk generally ended even the hint of revolt. He could deflect any of Latimer's desires. The youth was always broke during his years in Clayburgh's office, as might be expected on so low a salary. He was always falling behind in his bills for clothing and dry cleaning, and he relates with gratitude how Johnson consolidated his bills, and then collected his salary himself and paid the bills out of it, putting Latimer on a $10-per-week allowance. But he also relates how once, when the pain had been severe for some time, "I summoned up the considerable courage it took to ask him about the possibility of a small increase in salary. He listened with sympathetic concern, commented at some length on the shortage of money and jobs all over the country at the time, and especially in our own office, then told me he had been thinking for some time on how to reward the excellent work I'd been doing. He had finally decided that I merited having my name put on the office stationery as assistant secretary. As he described the prestige and glory of such an arrangement, I could see the printing stand out 6 inches." Latimer accepted the title instead of a raise. "I never questioned the procedure," Latimer says. "Indeed, it just seemed to follow as a matter of course." In general, he never questioned Johnson at all. Ask Latimer why he was willing to work so hard, and he replies first, "I guess I didn't know there was any other way to do it. He was the only guy I had worked for. And he keeps the pressure on you all the time." But Latimer himself knows this is only part of the explanation, and he soon goes on. For Gene Latimer, 65 years old at the time he spoke, sitting alone in a little apartment in a little town in Texas, a tiny Irish elf with sad eyes that often spill over with tears as he describes his life as an employee of Lyndon Johnson, so that he periodically excuses himself and goes into the bathroom to wash them off, understands, even if he was unable to cure, his own psychological dependence on Johnson. To listen to him talk is to hear a man who is fully aware that during his 16th year, he surrendered, for life, his own personality to a stronger personality. To listen to him talk is to hear a man who is fully aware that he has been used as a tool. Once, during the long days he spent with the author in his little apartment, difficult days for both men, he said, "He never talked to me too much, because with someone like me all he wanted was to keep me busy. When he saw me, 'Where's your stenographer's book? I want you to take this down.' When he saw me, he just wanted to know what orders he could give me." But the awareness is accompanied by acceptance, not resentment. Johnson called him son. He called Johnson chief. Asked if he ever called Johnson by his first name, he replied, shocked, "I would never have dreamed of calling him by his first name. He was the chief." Lyndon Johnson had found a man who liked taking orders as much as he liked giving them. Gene Latimer speaks of Lyndon Johnson with idolatry. "I don't think he's ever been scared in his life." And he talks of him with fear. "He can be mean. He can make people cry. He can make you feel so bad that you could go out and shoot yourself." And he talks of him with a feeling deeper than idolatry or fear. "I had such tremendous respect for the man," he says. "I don't know any other man I had such respect for. And hell, you just had faith. Hell, he could talk you into anything and make you feel it was right and absolutely necessary and proper. He can make you cry, he can make you laugh, he can do anything. And if you like him, then he puts things on such a personal basis, you know. You felt like I belonged to him and he belongs to me. Whatever you do it for him." He did a lot for him. Gene Latimer would work for Lyndon Johnson for the next 35 years as his slave, his totally willing slave. This term of service would not, however, be continuous. In 1939 began the first in a series of many nervous breakdowns. Latimer spent a substantial portion of his life recuperating from them and from recurrent severe bouts of alcoholism. He understood their cause. "The work broke me," he says, "but as soon as he recuperated, he would always return to the same work, because the work was for Lyndon Johnson." Johnson's relationship with L.E. Jones was more complex. The tall, handsome Jones was a very different type of personality, a brilliant young man who would later be known as the finest appellate lawyer in Texas, a lawyer's lawyer consulted by even its most famous attorneys. "He is," one magazine stated, "the man with probably the finest technical legal knowledge in the state." L.E. was as precise as Latimer was easygoing. "His shorthand looked like it was printed in a book," Gene says. "As stiff and cold as Latimer was warm. And he was very ambitious. He was willing to work the killing hours that Johnson demanded because Johnson had played on that ambition. 'You work hard for me and I'll help you.'" Jones would remember being awakened at 5 a.m. and walking to the office in the snow and wondering, was it worth it? But he concluded it was worth it because, "I always had the feeling that if I worked for Lyndon Johnson, goodies would come to me. I was on the make, too. I wanted to improve myself." He was, however, also very independent as Latimer was dependent. In later life, he would never join a law firm because he did not want partners. At the peak of his career, when he was earning impressive legal fees, he worked alone in a converted book-lined garage behind his house in Corpus Christi. His willingness to work endless hours for Lyndon Johnson did not include a willingness to surrender his personality to him. He was afraid of surrendering his personality. "Lyndon was always in a position of command," he says. "I never felt equal. Ordinarily, I'm aggressive and belligerent. My nature is such that if I can't be an equal, I will not remain in a situation. And he was so demanding that, well, you lose your individuality if you allow someone to be too demanding for too long." A struggle, never stated, but Jones feels understood by both men, went on. Johnson ridiculed the college education Jones had obtained with such effort, and of which he was so proud. Letters Jones wrote would be rejected, slashed across, and if Jones asked for an explanation, Johnson would say they were too literary. "Is that what they taught you at college, L.E.? Dumbest goddamn thing I ever read." A mistake in spelling in an L.E. Jones letter, recalls another man who spent some time in Claybird's office, was a very rare thing, but whenever there was one, Johnson made quite a point of it. "My God, L.E., aren't you ever going to learn how to spell? Don't they teach you anything in college?" For some time, Jones refused to surrender. If Johnson was discussing current events over dinner, and Jones saw a parallel to something that had happened in Rome or Greece, he would mention it, despite Johnson's displeasure. If he disagreed with Johnson, he would express his disagreement. If he had an opinion, he would state it. A surrender of sorts was to occur, however. Strikingly neat and clean, invariably well scrubbed, his hair carefully slicked down, every button buttoned on his double-breasted suits, his shirts highly starched, Jones was as aloof and reserved, almost prim, in physical matters as about everything else. "Any kind of coarseness or crudeness just disgusted him," a friend says. Johnson began making Jones take dictation from him while Johnson was sitting on the toilet. The toilet in Clayburgh's office suite was set in a short corridor between its two rooms. Johnson would sit down on it, and Latimer says, "There would come a call. L.E.? L.E. would say, "Oh, God," because he hated this. He would take his pad and go to the bathroom. At first he attempted to stand away from the door, but Johnson insisted he come right into the doorway so that he would be standing over him, and L.E. would stand with his head and nose averted and take dictation. In later years, Johnson's penchant for forcing subordinates to watch him defecating would be called by some an example of a wonderful naturalness. Others would find it, as one journalist put it, in part a method of control. Bring Douglas Dillon into the bathroom with you, and he has a little less independent dignity. This tactic was, indeed, a method of control. The first person on whom it was employed was L.E. Jones, and those who observed it knew it was being done to humiliate him and to prove to him who was boss. Jones had little choice but to accept the humiliation. The job was his only chance to realize his ambition. He continued working for Johnson for more than 2 years, until in 1935 he had saved enough money to pay for tuition at the University of Texas Law School. Then he left for Austin. He and Johnson were on friendly terms when he left. Johnson told him that when he finished law school, he would keep his promise and help him get a government job. But leave he did. To a friend who asked him why, he said he felt that if he stayed, he'd be devoured. The later Johnson-Jones relationship reveals the quality Johnson considered indispensable in a subordinate. He did indeed help Jones obtain a government job as an attorney with the Justice Department in 1938. And kept in touch with him thereafter, when Jones was in private practice. In his most desperate crisis, the legal battle that climaxed the 1948 senatorial election, he turned to him, asking Jones to join his legal team for the duration of the crucial appeal, and Jones did indeed join it. The end of the appeal, however, signaled the end of any working relationship. The Johnson-Jones relationship contrasts sharply with that between Johnson and Latimer. Jones was the more intelligent of the two assistants, and Johnson's awareness of his brilliance is proven by the fact that Johnson turned to him in time of crisis. From 4 years of personal observation, moreover, Johnson must have realized that Jones would have been the hardest working of aides. But except for 2 brief periods of part-time employment, Jones would never again be on his payroll, and Latimer would be on it for much of his life. What are the implications of this contrast? Was brilliance not enough to qualify a man for permanent work for Lyndon Johnson? Was hard work not enough? In fact, as would be demonstrated as soon as Johnson began hiring men on a large scale, the crucial qualification was subservience. Dignity was not permitted in a Johnson employee. Pride was not permitted. Utter submission to Johnson's demands, a submission that Jones called a surrender of personality, a loss of your individuality to his domination, was required. Otherwise, no matter how brilliant or hard-working, a man or woman could not work for Lyndon Johnson. Chapter 14. The New Deal. For For almost a year and a half after he went to work for Richard Clayburg, veterans were, in general, the only constituents for whom Lyndon Johnson could win victories. Though the mail sacks might be bulging with pleas for help, he had no help to give. Outside San Antonio, the 14th District was farming country, and for farmers, the crash had come long before 1929, with the resumption after the war of the great harvests of Europe. The 1920s had been one long bad decade for farmers. After Black Thursday, times grew worse. Prices fell, and fell, and fell again, until they reached levels not seen in generations or even in centuries. By 1932, farmers were being paid 25 cents for a bushel of wheat, 10 cents for a bushel of oats, 7 cents for a bushel of corn, prices below what they had been in colonial days. The prices of some farm commodities were, in actual value, at the level of the Middle Ages. While farmers were forced to sell low, they were also forced, in part by tariffs which kept high the price of manufactured goods, to buy dear. By 1930, it took a farmer almost 3 wagon loads of produce to buy the manufactured goods that 1 wagon load would have purchased in 1920. War-inflated crop prices had lured him into debt to buy more land and new machinery to work it, so that he could raise more crops. The plunge in crop prices made paying off that debt impossible. He was, in fact, forced to go deeper into debt just to purchase seed for another crop. The mortgage load on American farms, $3 billion when the war began, was $10 billion in 1930. The interest on those mortgages was so high that farmers could not pay it. During a 5-year period ending March 1, 1932, one out of every 8 farms in the United States would be up for forced sale because of mortgage or tax delinquencies. All during the 1920s, farmers held out a hand to their government, but the administrations of Harding and Coolidge were deaf to their pleas. Seeing the industrialists of the Northeast prospering behind a wall of protective tariffs, tariffs that helped the Northeast at their expense, farmers asked for tariff reform. But when, in 1927, Congress finally passed the McNary-Haugen Bill for tariff reform, Coolidge vetoed it, claiming it violated the sacred principle of laissez-faire. Although, as the historian Frank Friedel notes, on the very day of his veto, he signed an order increasing by 50% the tariff on pig iron. In 1928, Congress passed McNary-Haugen again. Coolidge again vetoed it. In 1929, Herbert Hoover, Coolidge's Secretary of Commerce, builder of the immense Department of Commerce building that was a temple to American business, became president, having carried 40 of the 48 states. A new tariff bill was introduced. Hoover said that if it was passed, he would veto it, so Congress didn't bother to pass it. Farmers asked for debt relief. Hoover's reply was that federal mortgages were already available, and so they were, from a federal agency whose directors seemed to feel that they were running a company store, so onerous were the terms of its loans. By 1931, one out of every 4 of its borrowers was delinquent, and the agency was busily foreclosing. During 1931 alone, almost 4,000 American families were thrown off their farms by their government. Hoover's solution for falling farm prices was the creation of a federal farm board, empowered to stabilize farm prices by buying a farmer's produce for more than it was worth. While the farm board's right hand was working to implement this solution, however, its left hand was working against it. Even farmers, traditionally among the most independent and conservative of Americans, now were coming to understand that the heart of the problem was overproduction. That, as one writer put it, surplus is ruin. There was a surprising amount of agreement among farm groups that some kind of government limit on production was necessary. But the farm board, by paying high prices for crops while refusing to limit the amount grown, encouraged farmers to grow more rather than less. The funds Hoover committed to the board, inadequate to begin with, ran out without even a dent being made in the agricultural crisis. The net result of its policies may, in fact, have made it worse. Hoover's solution was to ask farmers, many of whom were unable to survive on what they were presently raising, to voluntarily raise less. By the time Congressional Secretary Lyndon Johnson arrived in Washington in December 1931, the American farmer's long slide toward ruin had become a headlong plunge. Foreclosures on farms, many by rural banks which themselves were teetering on the brink of failure, had reached a rate of 20,000 per month. By the end of that year, one quarter of Mississippi had been auctioned off, one third of Iowa. Moreover, as William Allen White wrote, "Even though a man has no mortgage on his farm, even though he is not in immediate danger, he is, as a matter of fact, running behind. Every farmer, whether his farm is under mortgage or not, knows that with farm products priced as they are today, sooner or later he must go down." The southern part of Texas's 200-mile-long 14th congressional district had been insulated throughout the 1920s from the despair roaming the American countryside. The fall in cotton prices was cushioned by the quantity of the crop that could be produced in that 4-foot-deep loam. In 1929, Nueces County, hub of the southern part of the district, produced 424,000 bales of cotton, more than any other county in the United States. And by the ease in getting it to market, since ships heading for Europe and the East Coast could dock at Corpus Christi within a few miles of the cotton fields, freighting costs and the cost in time were reduced to a minimum. In many instances, exulted the Corpus Christi caller, "Cotton has been picked and ginned in the morning and compressed and loaded for export the same day." Even during the first year of the Depression, cotton buyers continued to crowd the seaport city with its row of tall office buildings along the bluff. But when the White Bowls opened on the Gulf Plain in 1931, warehouses throughout the world were still choked with unsold bales from the 1930 crop. Few ships came, prices plummeted to 6 cents per pound, a level at which it didn't pay to grow cotton, and even at that price there were few buyers. Only 330,000 bales would be picked along the Gulf in 1931, and 56,000 of these bales remained unsold. Prices for the onions and tomatoes and watermelons produced by the area's thousands of small truck farms dropped so low in that year that farmers let them rot on the vine. Human evidence of the Depression's existence had begun to filter into Corpus Christi early, for railroads had laid tracks to the very beaches of the Gulf. Despite the railroad's diligence, the Southern Pacific boasted that its dicks threw 683,000 vagrants off its trains in 1931. The long lines of freight cars from the north, now often carried, huddled in corners or riding the rails underneath, human cargo, which debarked when it reached Corpus Christi because that was the end of the line. For a while, local residents seemed to regard the Depression as something that couldn't happen to them. When it proved impossible to ignore the transients because of their number and importunity, they set up soup kitchens for strangers seeking food to keep them out of the residential areas. Their attitude toward people who couldn't earn a living was condescending. By 1931, however, with cotton unsold in the warehouses and tomatoes rotting in the fields, the lines at the soup kitchens were no longer composed entirely of strangers. Even prosperous Gulf Coast farmers were going into debt. By the end of the year, more than half of the 20,000 farms in the 14th district were under mortgage. And now the debts were being called. Farmers saw sheriff's sale notices being tacked up on neighbors' houses, on the houses of men who worked as hard as they did. They saw neighbors loading their cars high with their possessions and driving away with their wives crying and their babies looking bewildered and their older children's faces averted in shame. Some they never saw again. Some they did, and wished they hadn't. They saw former neighbors, friends, living in shacks in Corpus Christi or Robstown or Alice, and seeking day work. So desperate were these men that they were willing to pick cotton even in the rain and mud. In the past, because a man must pick cotton on his knees, picking had never been done, at least not by white men, when the fields were muddy. And evicted South Texas farmers couldn't earn enough to support their families even by working in the mud. "My boy and I worked full 9 hours Saturday and made 90 cents, or 5 cents per hour each," said one man who referred to himself as a former member of the middle class. More and more had to go on relief. So hard was it for these proud Texans to seek charity that they did not do so until they had sold everything they could sell. Many showed up at the Red Cross or Salvation Army staggering from weakness. They had refused to come in until they were literally starving. Some of the men, a Salvation Army worker reported, would never have come in at all had it not been for their inability to watch their wives starve. With the approach of the winter of 1931-32, the families living in the shacks needed heat and warm clothing as well as food. Appealing for donations of old stoves, Mrs. L. D. Berry, director of the local Red Cross, made clear that she meant wood stoves. "There is no need for gas stoves, as none of the families can afford gas," she noted. The families in the shacks were luckier than some families. They at least had shelter. A growing number of evicted farm families did not. Elderly men and women, afraid they would die of exposure during the winter, advertised their services in exchange for room and board. The Salvation Army set up 50 cots in an empty warehouse that would once have been filled with cotton. Hundreds of persons lined up to use them. Not only the elderly, but the young were in need. Children were growing out of their clothes and their shoes. Then Mrs. Berry started asking children in school what they had had to eat that day. As a result of their answers, she announced that the Red Cross must immediately begin providing at least one meal a day for 500 schoolchildren. But the Red Cross had no money to do so. Relief funds were running out. Since President Hoover felt that any involvement in relief by the federal government would weaken the national character, relief remained the province of local municipalities and private agencies. And as winter approached, not only the municipalities of the 14th District, but its Red Cross and Salvation Army chapters and local relief committees were all running out of money. Bacon and onions were no longer ingredients in soup kitchen meals. Beans, plain beans, were what the hungry were given to eat. The Salvation Army had reduced its allocation for feeding each client to a penny per day. Its funds were virtually exhausted. And each day, the soup kitchen lines grew longer. By the time Lyndon Johnson arrived in Washington, the district's arrogance was gone. Its people were asking the government for help now, for government participation in relief funding, for government refinancing of farm mortgages, for government support of crop prices, and more, because surplus is ruin, for government-enforced crop controls. There was desperation in the mail sacks he opened each morning. There was desperation in the mail sacks of almost every congressman, it seemed. Americans everywhere were asking their government for help. Despair was stalking city streets as well as the countryside. In Chicago, 600,000 persons were unemployed. In New York, 800,000. The total of unemployed men in America's cities was between 15 million and 17 million, and many of these men represented an entire family in want. Witnesses were telling congressional committees that private charities had run out of money, that states and local municipalities, which had attempted to shoulder the burden, had run out of money. That for want of federal assistance in relief, growing numbers of America's people were, literally, starving. During that session of Congress, there were reminders of the nation's plight not only in Washington's committee rooms, but in Washington's streets. 25,000 reminders. The penniless World War veterans who, in May 1932, marched up Pennsylvania Avenue, their faces set in concentration as they tried to march in step as they had marched when they were young, and who then encamped with their wives and children in abandoned warehouses and empty stores, and in tents set up in parks, so that Washington, D.C. resembled the besieged capital of an obscure European state. But little help came from the government. This book is continued on cassette number 2, side 1.